The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
We were very critical in the book of liberal Democrats who, after Trump's election, elected leaders, declared things like, this is not our president, he's not a legitimate president, actively boycotted the inauguration. We think that response was deeply problematic. He was an elected president. We don't yet have the conclusions of the Mueller investigation. We have no reason yet to think, or certainly to know, that the election was interfered with. So he's the legitimate president of the United States. And there should not have been impeachment talk on day one of the Trump presidency. We're very critical of that. That's not something that politicians, elected leaders, should be doing in a healthy democracy.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 1st, 2018. It's May Day, folks, but instead of a maypole, I had in my office today Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, authors of the new book, How Democracies Die. The book is part of a growing literature of democratic anxiety in the Trump administration, but with a twist. These comparativist political scientists take the lens of looking at other democracies and the threats that have brought them to their knees. We talked about the parallels with other countries that have gone through similar populist challenges. We talked about whether other consolidated democracies have ever really failed. And we talked about the prospects and challenges for the future as the United States muddles through its experiment with Trumpism and populism. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 306, Democracy's Morticians, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt on How Democracies Die. I want to start with the title, and specifically the question, how, seems to me to blur an antecedent question that I don't want to skip over, which is, do democracies die? And specifically, do consolidated democracies die? I know that no doubt that all kinds of incipient or early democracies fail and cease to be democratic. But what is the history of the death of consolidated established democracies?
It's a great question. And the answer is that they die very infrequently. Very, very few established, fully democratic regimes have ever died. And particularly none even remotely as wealthy or as established. One of the points of your question is that a comparison to a place like Russia, which was never a fully democratic regime, is really not an apt comparison. If we're going to look at warning signs about the crisis or the breakdown or threats to American democracy, we want to look at comparable regimes. And there aren't many of them. We ended up focusing a fair amount of time on Chile, which is probably the best comparison, the most established democracy in the world that has broken down. Contemporary Venezuela is another one, was a pretty established democracy that broke down in the 2000s. But very few consolidated democracies have died.
So let's work with Chile for a minute, because I think you guys rightly focus on it as a singular case. How established was democracy in Chile in 1973 when it fell apart, or when it ceased, you know, in a violent coup to be democratic?
Well, it was becoming deconsolidated. Chilean politics became very polarized over the course of the 1960s and the early 1970s, in part because the illiterates were given the right to vote, peasants for the first time were becoming mobilized, the working class was becoming much more mobilized, and the left, the party of the left, went from being essentially social democratic to becoming Marxist. So politics on both sides, landowners were terrified of losing their land to now empowered peasants, and the left was going from radical, or really social democratic, to revolutionary. So things became very polarized in the beginning in the 1960s, over the course of the late 1960s. So the regime was deconsolidating for a while before it collapsed. But certainly by Latin American standards, the regime had been in place for a couple of generations. It had been in place since 1932. So it was pretty well established. And one of the things that attracted to us as a comparative case is Chile also was known for having pretty well-established democratic norms, the kinds of norms that we talk about in the book of mutual toleration and forbearance. They were quite well-established, very, very similar norms in many respects, despite the fact that you had a real sort of Marxist left and a very reactionary right. Politicians from both parties for decades had been able to sit down and negotiate and obviously disagree, but live together in the same democracy.
All right, so we have an example of a consolidated long-term but deconsolidating democracy falling apart in a bloody coup. You also mentioned Venezuela. It's a less long-term example, but has a different model of deconsolidation, which early in the book you point out, look, we think about democracy death in terms of coups, but there's this other model that, frankly, though it's a left model in Venezuela, looks a lot Trumpier.
Right.
So walk us through the Venezuelan counterexample.
Sure. Venezuela is a classic case of populism, which, as you point out, can be of a left-wing variant or could be of a right-wing variant. Venezuela, much more so than Chile, and frankly more than the United States, is a case where the political elite failed miserably. The country began to slide into recession in the late 1970s and basically never came out of it. Failed to grow over the course of more than a decade. People were sliding into poverty. The state, because of, in part because of oil revenue, sort of became very corrupted. And so the political elite for nearly a generation had failed to deliver the goods in a way that's, you know, exceeds the United States by a long shot. And in that context, Hugo Chavez emerges, first tries to lead a coup, shocks the world because Venezuela was considered by Venezuelans and certainly by the Venezuelan elite to be a consolidated democracy. So shocked the entire country by attempting a coup, and then shocked the country even further, or the fact that the coup was actually quite popular among the poor would prove shocking in a way that sort of we're shocked that many people embrace what we view as, you know, anti-democratic behavior, authoritarian or illiberal behavior by Donald Trump. Chavez tries a coup, is actually quite popular, and then runs for office, bashing the entire system, running the Venezuelan version of "I will drain the swamp, only I can solve our problems," was elected, and then proceeded slowly and through democratic means, through the use of elections, plebiscites, and eventually congressional majorities and a packed court, was able to use democratic institutions over the course of a decade to bury democracy. So that's very different than generals seizing power in a coup.
Right. Although it starts with that attempt.
It does.
He goes to jail, too.
He went to jail for the coup attempt and was released by established party politician.
So both of those are extremely disturbing cases. And neither of them is a democracy with a 200-year-plus tradition of increasing democratic. I mean, the United States, you know, probably by modern standards doesn't become a democracy until sort of well into the 20th century. But It certainly has democratic institutions from quite early on. It has an uninterrupted history of elections. It has increasingly liberal institutions. Is there an example of democratic failure of a country like that?
No.
I mean, and so there's lots of good empirical social science work showing that.
So this is Daniel Ziblatt.
Yeah.
The previous speaker to all questions was Stephen Levitsky. And I will try to make sure the listener can get to a cue as to who's speaking whenever they switch.
So lots of good social science research shows. I mean, there's most things in social science people debate the findings, but there's two findings that people don't debate. One is the richer a democracy is, the less likely it is to break down, looking at countries in the 20th century, and the older a democracy is, the less likely it is to break down. And so unlike people, as people get older, they're more likely to die. As democracies get older, they're more likely to survive. And so, that's certainly the case. And the U.S., because it's a very old democracy, depending how one measures it, is very unlikely to break down. That's right. But, I guess part of the premise of the book, certainly, is that doesn't mean that there aren't lessons to be drawn from other cases.
Right. So this is a great transition to the thesis of the book, which is that there is a threat. Right. And that there is, you can't read about the history of of other country democratic failures and not get anxious about the history that we've seen in the last two plus years in this country. But I wanted to start with that generally optimistic point that we are dealing, if we are going through the stages of democratic death in the United States, it is an unprecedented democratic catastrophe. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, and that's why we often say we don't think American democracy is dead or dying. I mean, there's many ways in which we see echoes of things happening in other countries, and it's hard to know what the pace at which things die. So that's, there's a quote there's a line in The Sun Also Rises from Hemingway, where one character asks the other character, "How did you go bankrupt?" And he responds, he says, "Well, two ways. First, very slowly, and then very quickly." And so does democracy die like that? I don't know. I mean, there's some sense that it does, but there's other ways in which what we're witnessing, it's hard. Part of the point of trying to find these warning signs and looking at other countries is to sort of get a grip on what's happening. But it's still very difficult to really know where we are in that process.
In our position, I mean, there are wide spectrum of views about the health of American democracy today. Everything from folks who are screaming that fascism is on the corner to those who say, Trump can't even repeal Obamacare. How much of a danger is he really? We position ourselves broadly in the middle of that debate in the sense that we think there is good reasons for optimism. There are reasons to sleep reasonably well at night, good social science reasons. On the other hand, we think given the warning signs that we identify, and many people have identified, we think it's a mistake for citizens and politicians to take U.S. democracy for granted. We think that all of us have done that. We've acted as if our politicians can behave as recklessly as they want them to, as we want them to, and that we couldn't possibly break American democracy. And we think that is dangerous.
All right. So before we dive into the specific warning signs that the book deals with, I want to ask the flip question to the, is there an example of a consolidated democracy failing as catastrophically as the United States would fail if this were failure? And that is whether there are examples of consolidated democracies facing these democratic challenges and really fighting them off. And in one of the early chapters of the book, you guys talk about Finland and Belgium in the pre-war era fighting off genuine fascist challenges. I'm wondering, what are the examples you would identify of democracies facing the most catastrophic challenges and succeeding in fighting them off?
Well, the Belgium example is interesting, but this is a case in the 1930s of a far-right politician who had a march on Brussels trying to imitate Hitler and Mussolini, wanting to come to power and participating in elections like these other folks in the 1930s and 1920s, and the centrist parties gathering together and deciding, including the center-right party, deciding that they, and under no conditions, would form a coalition with this party and actively trying to undermine the party through the encouragement of the king of Belgium, who is a moral authority. So this is a case of preventing somebody from getting into power in the first place. So that's pretty severe. That's a pretty severe crisis. But in some sense, if one regards the current administration as a threat to democracy, the question is, once somebody's in power, is there an analogous situation to that? And so that's maybe, I don't know if you, Steve, you have a case.
I was thinking about a few cases of polarization and conflict. But the Netherlands is another case that early part of the 20th century was deeply divided between left and right, also religious versus secular, Catholic, Protestant. It was a really intense conflict in the first two decades in the Netherlands that politicians managed to sort of, in a relatively farsighted way, kind of figure out a new way of doing politics in which they would kind of protect the interests of each of the major parties and solve problems via coalition building and negotiation. Another place that you would have to look is the United States itself. In an important sense, by modern standards, a full democracy prior to the Civil War. But we've had periods, we identified at least three periods of intense conflict in the United States where the constitutional system survives. The 1790s, the early decades of the American Republic, as a Latin Americanist, look very familiar. The kind of constitutional hardball and the intense polarization that existed. I mean, this was before the idea of legitimate opposition had really taken hold in the West, particularly the Washington and Adams administrations are facing Jeffersonian opposition. That was a tough time.
Including from within the administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously the Civil War is a case where really the system breaks down for a few years, but we cobble it back together. And the Depression in the Roosevelt administration was another period of pretty intense conflict and potential threat. That's where some of the greatest, over the last century, where we pushed up against the guardrails more than in other periods. So the U.S., I think, provides some of the best examples of surviving, overcoming, averting deeper crisis.
One other interesting case that probably gets less attention because everything ended up working out okay was Britain before 1914. So really 1913, 1914, there was a genuine risk of civil war over Ireland and home rule for Ireland, in which the arms were being shipped to the Ulster Unionists and debates were taking place. And if you look actually at bond markets in this period, in 1913, 1914, it's clear the bond markets were thought that a civil war may genuinely come to Great Britain. You know, how that ultimately was averted, partly this was through parliamentary negotiations, but also the onset of World War I kind of put an end to all of that. So that was a kind of moment of crisis that was closely averted, I would argue.
All right. So with all of that as preface, you identify the four sort of great warning signs of, shall we say, declining democratic health or threat to democratic government. Well, walk us through that.
Well, there are a couple of different things that I would distinguish. Those four warning signs, which we draw, they're sort of a reconfiguration of warning signs that the Spanish political scientist Juan Linz, who was a student of democratic breakdown in interwar Europe, identified in his book. It's sort of a classic political science book published in the late 1970s, The Breakdown of Democratic Regimes. He devised what he called a litmus test for identifying authoritarians before they come to power. And so those four warning signs are an effort to sort of guide the public to identify figures, individuals who you probably don't want to give the keys to the White House to. And so those four warning signs are a willingness to reject existing democratic rules of the game, a willingness to withdraw or crack down on basic civil liberties of your opponents, a willingness to encourage or condone violence, and a refusal to accept the legitimacy of your rival. So behave. If you see the argument of the book is that you see a candidate who checks off one or more of those boxes, probably a good idea not to nominate, not to, to vote for them. That is, that's important because one of the keys to defending democracy is preventing anti-democratic actors from getting to power in the first place, as Daniel mentioned earlier. That's not where we focus, that's not where we see the greatest threat to American democracy. We think the election of, and we spent several chapters on the election of Trump and the election of authoritarian figures, but that's only part of the story.
How would you describe the rest of the story?
Well, I guess the question is, once somebody gets into office, will the institutions contain the person? I mean, so if somebody shows clear willingness to violate democratic norms, as, you know, fails this litmus test or passes the litmus test, once they're in office, what happens next? And so a big part of the story then is, can, you know, we tend to think our checks and balances will constrain in the United States and constrain the ambitions of a political leader who seems indifferent at best to democratic norms. And so what we argue, though, is that many of the things that we think of as being the constraints, the Constitution, which is a very short document at the end of the day, that the constraints are not really what's written in the Constitution alone, but rather a set of norms or unwritten rules. And so what we, you know, and historically that's what we argue, and there's two that we talk about, and we talk more about that, these two key norms of mutual toleration and forbearance. Mutual toleration being willing to accept your rivals as legitimate contenders for power and as not as enemies, merely as rivals. You think that you may disagree with them, you may dislike them, but they have a legitimate right to rule and govern. So that's a kind of norm, an unwritten rule. And without that, it's hard for the Constitution to do its job. The second key norm is the norm, it's a little more unusual perhaps, the norm of forbearance, which means essentially self-restraint in the use of power and the exercise of power and the underutilization of power. And so we argue that throughout American history, at key moments, politicians have underutilized the power they have. And so that key norm, if that's not present, it's hard for the checks and balances to do their work. And so we're fearful that those norms are eroding. So that's the sort of second half of the book.
And we're fearful that those norms are eroding in a context of intensifying polarization. They're not just eroding because of Trump. Certainly, they're not eroding out of accident. They may be exacerbated by social media, but there is an underlying intensifying partisan polarization that's pulling these norms apart.
All right, so there are a lot of threads here, and let's try to pull them apart. The first is the underlying character of the individual. I think nobody can read those four warning signs about the individual and not feel at least a certain unease that we are in a land where all four of them are at least implicated, if not floridly so. The second is the larger atmosphere of constraint. The third is the general ambience of polarization. And the fourth is the willingness of the individuals in question and their opponents to behave with a certain set of virtues that allow other systems to work. So I want to focus on each of those separately. How confident are you that Donald Trump is a person who raises how many of the four issues that Lynn's identified as warning signs? I mean, is this somebody who, as a student of that literature, should alarm you as much as he seems to alarm a lot of people, including me?
Yes. I mean, I think he passes the test with 100% flying colors. I mean, in other words, these four items that we list, attacking civil liberties or media is one example. And so especially during the presidential campaign, if one looks at the rhetoric that was used, going after the media, saying the media is the enemy of the people. During the election campaign, when candidate Trump said he wouldn't necessarily accept the results of the election, and complained about rampant election fraud when there was no evidence of this. His threat to lock up his political rival and he didn't actively encourage violence at political rallies, but probably condoned it. So in that sense, maybe not a perfect score on that last one, but pretty frightening one. Now, so during the campaign, and that's really when we began to work on this book, we saw this, and it was fairly clear to us right away that there was rhetorical moves that were clearly matching these indicators. Now, we have we asked ourselves and often debated, and people often will ask us, well, isn't this just words? I mean, this is just rhetoric. You know, there was for a while this thing, you know, pay attention to what he does, not what he says. And that, you know, that's a fair point. I guess two reactions to that, though. The reason why we think words matter a great deal is that words, especially prominent political leaders' words, have a consequence. And so if one looks at attitudes towards the free press and the media in the United States today among Republicans, a majority of Republicans, I mean, there's recent surveys just reading about last week, the majority of Republicans think the press is conspiring against Trump and making up news, and there's lots of fake news is rampant. Lots of Republicans think that election fraud is rampant when there's actually clear evidence that it's not. And so public opinion is affected by these words. So the point here is that words are an important indicator of what somebody might do once in office, but they also matter a great deal because they actually shape political discourse and political debate and contribute to polarization.
And they do one other thing, which is provoke the opposition. So I've seen a number of cases in Latin America where populists come to power who don't necessarily have a long-term plan for authoritarianism. They weren't planning a coup. They really didn't have much of a plan at all in many cases. They're political outsiders who find their success in railing against the establishment, promising to drain the swamp, etc. And what they do is scare the bejesus out of the establishment, and which triggers kind of an escalating war. So they come to office having declared that they're going to bury the elite and consign them to the dustbin of history. And the establishment media and the establishment opposition parties and the courts are alarmed and are sort of hyper-vigilant and are very tough on this new president, who's often an outsider and not politically experienced and not very thick-skinned. And so the very tough response of the opposition in Congress, the courts, the establishment media, leaves the president feeling besieged and sort of begins this kind of tit-for-tat escalating process that can end up in a place where no one expected at the beginning.
And so to clarify here that, you know, these words that people, that politicians use before an office, in and of themselves don't constitute authoritarianism. The point is that this is a kind of warning sign of what might be to come. And so I think sometimes people will say, well, he hasn't implemented these things. And that's right, you know, in a lot of cases. And so that, you know, that's fine. And some authoritarians come to power through elections without lots of warning signs. Viktor Orban in Hungary is somebody who originally was a liberal, you know. And so it's not as if this is a perfect test that, you know, always proves correct when somebody's in office, but it's just essentially is to, you know, give us some kind of warning.
Certainly, with a big caveat that American institutions are considerably stronger than every other case that we studied. It's an important caveat. We have looked at a large number of cases of leaders who come to power with this sort of rhetoric, who pass this litmus test, and it usually does not end well. It usually ends up in a crisis.
And just to follow up on that, are there cases in which people come to power with all kinds of bombastic and irresponsible rhetoric and then are tamed by service in government because they are constrained by other actors, by limited decision sets? They end up behaving much more responsibly than their rhetoric would lead you to expect.
Yeah, certainly there are. I would say not a particularly well-known case, but in Peru, the previous president between 2011 and 2016, Ollanta Humala, came to power with a lot of bombastic rhetoric and ended up moderating and governing in a pragmatic fashion. You know, Berlusconi, for all of his irresponsible behavior on many fronts, his bark in terms of democracy, for sure, ended up being considerably worse than his bite, perhaps even de Gaulle in many respects.
Yeah, but some of these figures, I mean, I think the far right in Western Europe tends to not actually be as overt in its violation of democratic norms. So in other words, you know, even if these parties are anti-immigrant and racist and so on, but you know, they're participating in the democratic game. The AfD in Germany today is not a party that, you know, it calls for referenda and it sort of makes a populist appeal, a kind of grassroots populist appeal. It tends not to as overtly violate democratic norms in the run-up to campaigns. So those are different.
All right, so the next basket of protections that you guys talk about is the gatekeeper functions. And here you identify really a grave failure on the part of the Republican Party. So let's talk about that institutional performance. Where do you see that failure as happening?
Well, there was two failures. you know, throughout American history, one of the points we make in the book is that there have often been demagogic figures with authoritarian tendencies, that Donald Trump was actually not the first. I mean, going just in the 20th century, Henry Ford was somebody who considered running for president, you know, Huey Long, Joe McCarthy, who wasn't considering running for president but was very popular, George Wallace. And these were figures who generally were quite popular, you know, 35% approval ratings in Gallup polls. The reason these figures never made it close to power was a system of gatekeeping, namely the way we select our presidential candidates. Until 1972, we had a system in which essentially primaries were not binding and were almost irrelevant. And really, party leaders got together at conventions and decided on who the candidate would be, who it ought to be. And so this was a system that political scientists at the time called the system of peer review. It wasn't particularly democratic, smoke-filled back room, but these guys got together and knew the various features of different potential candidates' personalities and could, even though they were trying to win elections, they could keep demagogues out. We never had somebody come through that system with authoritarian tendencies. So the head of a party ticket was never somebody clearly violating these democratic norms that we've been talking about. So this all changed, of course, in 1972 with the introduction of open primaries, binding primaries. And so now voters could select their candidates within the parties before the general election. And, this, again, is a system that was more democratic, more transparent, more open. But at the time, the same political scientist who had talked about the peer review, Nelson Polsby, a student of American politics, argued that this might open the door to demagogues potentially. And so this is one major change that took place. But, you know, this has been in place since 1972, and we haven't had a figure like this coming to the top of the ticket. So the second really factor that I think the second big change is the role of the Republican Party itself in 2016. And in particular, you know, it was very clear that most Republicans leaders did not particularly like Donald Trump. They had other candidates they favored. As the kind of nature of the primary system unfolded, Republican leaders did not distance themselves from him. And so in many ways, we regard this as a major failure in political leadership, that rather than kind of organizing themselves in a way, I mean, there was lots of attempts, certainly. But once it came to the general election, if you had a Republican nominee and a Democratic nominee facing off, there was about a 50-50 chance that Donald Trump would win. And so at that point, you know, Republican leaders could have, we argue, and we make this case in the book, could have endorsed Hillary Clinton. They could, you know, and none did. No major leading Republican politician did. And, you know, some people will say, well, this is naive to think that they would endorse the rival, you know, the other party. But it turns out if you look at other countries, in France, actually in 2017, with a two-round presidential election, France's Republican Party, the Conservative Party candidate François Fillon, didn't make it to the second round. And rather than endorsing Marine Le Pen, who is on the far right, maybe ideologically closer to him, or even remaining silent, he instead endorsed the Emmanuel Macron, who had been a minister in a socialist government. So this was a case of somebody crossing party lines to support somebody who is the major opponent. So, you know, we argue that this could have happened. Again, you know, it's demanding a lot. It's a kind of last-ditch effort, but to sort of stop the rise of Trump. But when somebody clearly violates democratic norms, again, drawing on Linz, you know, he makes the case that throughout European history and in a democratic breakdown, if you don't have political allies stepping up, then democracy is put at risk.
And this is a case where we think Republican leaders probably took American democracy for granted. And so they made a bet, and they may be right. I mean, our democratic institutions may well muddle through. We may not enter into some kind of calamitous war because we put someone unfit for the office of the presidency in allowed that to happen. But that was a pretty reckless move by Republican leaders to allow someone who they themselves in private identified as not fit for the presidency to go forward.
And just one other thing on this. I mean, there was a dilemma, certainly, that Republicans faced, a difficult dilemma. What to do when there's somebody coming up on your side who you think may not be fit for office or is a threat to democracy. But one of our points in the book is to highlight that this is not a new dilemma. I mean, there was maybe a sense that people felt that we're in this really tough bind. This is really unusual. But you look back historically, you know, Italian liberals were afraid of Benito Mussolini. Didn't know what kind of threat he was, but knew he was popular, and they made the mistake of allying with him and including Mussolini on party lists. You know, German conservatives who didn't want Hitler to come to power, but nonetheless appointed him chancellor with the idea that they could control him. So this dynamic And clearly, these are very different cases. I mean, this is one of the points that, you know, American democracy is much older than these other cases. These were new democracies. But this particular dynamic of establishment politicians making this calculation that they can, there's an outsider who they can, whose popularity they can tap into and who they can control, is a recurring dilemma. And people often make the wrong choice on this.
Let's talk about once the gatekeepers have failed, the guy is in power, and then you are heavily reliant on the performance of institutions. How have they done?
I think it's a mixed story so far. I mean, in general, I'm not an expert on the judiciary, but it seems to me like the judiciary has held up reasonably well. The media is a very diverse bunch. It's a mixed bag, and it's had some massive failures over the years. But I think that in general, the media is a democratic institution that has a certain watchdog role, and that the so-called mainstream media has done that reasonably well as well. I would give a lower grade to Congress, and particularly the Republican Party in Congress, where that's one area where we are now probably less optimistic than we were when we wrote the book. When we wrote the book, it looked as if there was a sort of a robust faction of Republicans in the Senate that would be able and willing to draw a line and to contain Trump, and that faction seems a lot weaker than it did a year and a half ago. So the behavior, for example, of the House Intelligence Committee, that's the behavior of a lapdog, not a watchdog. So it seems to us that Congress has a different role, obviously, when it's in the hands of the opposition and the hands of the governing party, but we have not seen Congress exercise much in the way of oversight and restraint so far.
What about civil society? I mean, so one of the things about Congress when you evaluate Congress is there seems to me there's at least three Congresses, right? There's the Congress that exists now. There's the Congress that you expect to exist after the next election, right? Which is a separate constraint on the administration, right? Because you have to behave in a way not merely that will survive scrutiny under this Congress, but under the next Congress as well. And you also have the Congress, the Platonic Congress that we think should exist, right? That I believe that there should be a Congress in which people put party aside and behave like institutionalists who have a separate branch of government, right? Those are three, as best as I can tell, three entirely separate entities. But it seems to me when you're evaluating Congress, an important feature of Congress is that it is iterative with respect to elections, and that those elections are iterative with respect to public sentiment, public energy. In that sense, you can't ignore the massive protests, the kind of sustained political energy. And so my question is, should we think about Congress purely in terms of the performance that we've seen from it so far, which I agree has been disappointing, or do you have to figure in also the kind of capacity for a very different congressional reaction if and when there is change in control?
Well, sure. I mean, institutions are embedded in society and in civil society, and they are dynamic and responsive, luckily, to society. It's pretty similar dynamic with the courts. The courts don't operate independent of protest and public opinion either.
No, but the courts next year are going to look a lot like the courts this year. And 2 years from now, they're going to look a lot like next year. But Congress is going to be much more finely responsive, either because people get scared of voter behavior or because voters actually throw them out, right?
It may. I mean, so if the public and civil society are antagonized by Trump and the Trump-led Republican Party, and that leads to what looks like is quite plausible, an opposition victory in the 2018 election, and the Democrats control the House after that, that will be a sign that one very important institution in our democracy, elections, works.
But
make this point briefly, there's also a scenario, which is also not out of the question, in which Democrats win the popular vote by 5 or 6 points and fail to capture either house, in which case elections will not have worked as well, and that would lead us very down a different path.
Did you want to- I was just going to say there's two other points though here. I mean, I agree that the elections this fall are critical. Whether you're Democrat or Republican, some level, you know, to see how these institutions respond to a sense that there's a large groundswell of support or resistance to the current administration. But there's kind of two further kind of caveats to that. One, you know, when there's this sort of sense in which the Republican Party needs to suffer an electoral defeat in order to come to its senses. I mean, there's a lot of people who kind of have this idea, what could lead to the reformation of the Republican Party? And election victories in our system are supposed to be this kind of, we have this idea of a kind of self-correcting marketplace of ideas. If you suffer an electoral defeat, you'll reform yourself. But what's certainly true is that if Democrats win over a bunch of purple-leaning seats in the House, what will House Republicans look like after this? I mean, they'll actually probably be even further to the right, more resistant to reform. And so it's not clear that this will automatically transform our system. So an election victory by Democrats may be a necessary kind of development, but it's certainly not sufficient. And the second point is, you know, what happens once Democrats retake, you know, let's say Democrats retake the Senate. I mean, one of the points that we talk about in the book is, you know, if, you know, there's a way in which many people think that Democrats should, you know, hold up Supreme Court nominations and not hold hearings and sort of do to President Trump what Republicans did to President Obama, you know, in this kind of blocking of even holding hearings for Supreme Court nomination. You know, there's a lot of pressure, I think, for Democrats maybe to do this. And we think, though, if Democrats do behave in these ways and mimic the behavior of Republicans, that this is ultimately destructive. So and leads to a spiral and a tit for tat. And so, you know, this is another potential. Even if Congress changes, you know, there is that. So,
right. So we don't know that much. In that sense, we don't know everything we need to know about the next Congress.
Fair enough. So that leads me to the fourth pillar, which is polarization. And one of the most interesting aspects of the book to me is this argument that is explicit in times and implicit other times, that polarization is a significant feature of nearly all democratic failures. And I had never focused on that before, and I'm interested to have you guys flesh it out. We talk about political polarization in the United States as a feature of a sort of Americanist political science, right? You know, this sort of debate that took place between a bunch of people here and the sort of Mo Fiorinas of the world, like how bad is political polarization in the United States? But this gives it a very interesting different valence, right? Which is, if you look at countries where democracies have failed, there's this polarization that always features in it. And so how does this, you know, tie this knot together? How should we understand American polarization in the context of polarization that leads to or can contribute to democratic collapses?
Well, so one thing that is true is that some polarization is probably okay for democracy. And in fact, you want heated debates over issues and people to disagree. So this is not an argument for consensus or a bland bipartisanship.
Right, not Scandinavia.
Right, you know, there needs to be debate, and there always is debate, and that's a good thing. It's extreme polarization that is dangerous when we look around the world, and what we mean by that is not only the ideological distance. You know, the metaphor of polarization suggests that it's sort of just simply ideological distance. It's not only ideological distance of right and left. It is the degree. It's the degree to which each side views the other side as a legitimate contender for power. So when each side views the other side, or one side views the other side, but even worse, when both sides view the other side as essentially enemies and threats to the well-being of the nation.
Right. So there's not there's a much the more, two are not unrelated. Deal. So ideological distance, growing ideological distance increases the likelihood that I will view my rival as an existential threat. But the two are not perfectly correlated. One can have quite a bit of ideological distance, as existed in Chile, at least for a while, might have survived had it not been for the Cold War, without seeing the other side as an existential threat.
On the other hand, when the other side prompts you to write a book entitled How Democracies Die, I don't think you get to be sort of above that discussion at all. You guys clearly regard Donald Trump as enough of an existential threat to democracy in America that he's an appropriate vehicle to write a book about how democracies die. You know, is this an analytic point or a normative point?
This is, I hope, an analytic point. I don't think Donald Trump is the greatest threat. I think Donald Trump is a symptom of an underlying polarization that poses the greatest threat. I actually worry most about how many Republicans, certainly not all Republicans, and an increasing number of actors within the Republican coalition view Democrats as an existential threat. I think Republican reaction and Republican perception, both publicly and privately, of Democrats as an existential threat is the single greatest threat
Let me just add to this. You said, you know, the question, you know, we're political scientists, we're observers, we're not sitting in the halls of Congress. I think there is, in fact, a difference between us as analysts in a fact-based world. This is not a postmodern world where every side is equally right. Looking at the evidence and the weight of the evidence, I think it's perfectly legitimate for analysts to try to assess, you know, our politicians behaving in ways that is reckless for the country.
Right.
It's another thing for, you know, I wouldn't suggest, for example, that the Democratic leaders in Congress to go around saying that their opponents are a threat to democracy. So I think there is a difference between political leaders making this kind of public statements about this and analysts of politics.
Fair enough. But a few months ago, I had sitting in that exact chair Mike Duran of the Hudson Institute, who, for a kind of through-the-looking-glass conversation between me and a Trumpist. And if Mike Duran were here today, he would say, and I'm just speaking, you know, I don't speak for him, so if you hear this and you don't think I'm fairly representing your views, my apologies. You'll be my cutout for this point. But if Mike were here today, I think what he'd say is, you guys are kidding yourself. You wrote a book entitled How Democracies Die that totally delegitimize the other side, my side, as threat to democracy. And then you're sitting here saying the problem is that people, it's not ideological distance, it's viewing the other side as illegitimate. What about me? When do I get to be legitimate? What's wrong with that argument?
You know, at some point, again, we're living in a real world where there are genuine threats to democracy and there are fabricated threats to democracy. Somebody may disagree, but this is not a post... Unless you're a believer in the postmodern world in which every side has an equally valid opinion, that's not... We're saying, based on the evidence, this is a genuine threat. And somebody may say, well, you know, President Obama was a threat to democracy. And I would argue that the people who made those claims most of the time were fabricating evidence. These are not equally valid claims. And so I stand by our claims as being based in the real world.
To reiterate Daniel's first point, though, we were very critical in the book of liberal Democrats who, after Trump's election, elected leaders, declared things like, this is not our president, he's not a legitimate president, actively boycotted the inauguration. We think that response was deeply problematic. He was an elected president. We don't yet have the conclusions of the Mueller investigation. We have no reason yet to think, or certainly to know, that the election was interfered with. So he's the legitimate president of the United States. And there should not have been impeachment talk on day one of the Trump presidency. We're very critical of that. That's not something that politicians, elected leaders, should be doing in a healthy democracy.
Right. And yeah, so that's absolutely critical that we recognize, I mean, just in case it's unclear to anybody, and we recognize that President Trump was perfectly legitimately elected and, you know, has a right to govern and so on. I mean, that's not the issue. You know, I should say that there were many Republicans who thought that President Trump was not legitimately elected, that he wasn't a citizen. So, I mean, it's an unequal.
President Obama, rather.
Yeah.
In the book, you talk a lot about this concept of forbearance. And I think in an atmosphere of extreme polarization, the idea of forbearance is hard because for a lot of people on the left, there is a certainty that when you guys say forbearance, you're asking them to behave in a way that will not be shown to them and was not shown to them. And for a lot of people on the right, there is a very strong feeling that Trump is being subjected to an unprecedented opposition and, you know, hashtag resistance that is unlike anything any president has experienced before. And so you're asking them not to defend him. You're asking them not to respond. And so I guess my question is, what's the argument for forbearance in an atmosphere in which there is zero confidence on either side in a kind of prisoner's dilemma way that they will be shown forbearance.
It's precisely that. It's a difficult prisoner's dilemma. And the problem is, as hardball tactics escalate, as we go down this road of tit for tat, and, you know, they stole a Supreme Court seat, so we're going to steal it back, or they're, you know, if we don't respond with tit for tat, we're going to face an endless series of sucker punches, it gets harder and harder to trust the other side. And, you know, having seen the cycle of polarization in norm erosion elsewhere in the world, admittedly in democracies that were not as consolidated as America's, this escalation rarely ends well. It's much harder to step off the train later down the track than it is early on. So it's hard for Democratic leaders today, for the Democratic Party leadership, to tell the base, you know, even if we control the Senate, we are not, and even if the Supreme Court, you know, the future of the Supreme Court over the next generation is at stake, we are not going to hold up a Trump nomination if a vacancy opens up. And that's one concrete example that is being debated among Democrats and progressives today. It's very hard for political leaders to tell the base, to tell their allies, you know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to steal it back. But I think there's good reason to think that 10, 20 years down the road, after further escalation, it'll be much harder. Better to do it now, better to break the spiral of escalation now than at a point where it becomes really politically impossible.
And I would just add that, you know, Democrats, there's this view that Democrats demographically, you know, 30 years, 40 years from now, Democrats have a strong future for themselves. You know, that the, in some ways that the demographic sort of electoral basis of the Democratic Party is a good basis. So the question is, how do we get to that future with our democratic institutions intact? So the argument for Democrats is, you know, if they continue to play by the rules and democratic institutions remain intact, they have a bright future for themselves. The argument for Republicans is there's an argument for forbearance for Republicans as well, which is that if Democrats do come back into office, you want Democrats to act with forbearance. And so both sides really benefit from forbearance. Now, you know,
in the long run,
in the
if
long
you've
run,
got long time
in the
horizons.
Long run. And so what we, so the sort of conclusion then is, you know, we often think in politics, we often think, you know, elected officials make this calculation when trying to decide what to vote for something or to take a stand on a bit. They have policy priorities on the one hand, and then they have their electoral considerations. You know, you'll stand up for DACA if it doesn't cost you too much electorally. These are the two variables. They have this kind of ledger in their mind. What we're suggesting is that there's a third variable that elected officials ought to add, especially in moments of democratic crisis. And that third variable is, are the actions that I'm taking, the votes that I'm taking, are they reinforcing democratic institutions for the long run? Now, that's a kind of abstract consideration, but we think that at least is worth, you know, adding onto the ledger sheet. And if they do that, they will recognize that none of their policy priorities will be achieved without the long-run sustainability of democratic institutions. So this needs to at least be something that's on elected officials' minds.
So we speak more often to Democrats than to Republican opinion makers, and we get into pretty intense debates with progressives over this argument for forbearance because many, many progressives are still in the mode or are in the mode of arguing that Democrats need to learn to fight like Republicans or they're going to be sucker punched to death. So we've been having those debates for months with Democrats. But we actually think that that forbearance is a concept that looking forward is really useful, really important for Republicans. Republicans are going to face Democratic majorities soon. We don't know if it's 2018, 2020, but they will. And they're going to face an angry Democratic majority at some point. And so maintaining norms of forbearance and the institutions that they sustain is in the interest, at least in the medium term, of Republicans and conservatives as well.
My second book, which is about the judicial confirmation process, was an extended argument for what you would call forbearance, though I don't think the word ever appears in it. I have never lost a public argument faster than I did in the argument in that book, which was for a modest and deferential approach to judicial confirmations by the Senate. So I wish you excellent, the best of luck. May you have better luck with your argument for forbearance than I did. I don't know who will reject it more vociferously, the left or the right, but I'm confident you will gain no traction with either and that the fight is nonetheless worth it, if only to create a record that the argument was made and rejected. Stephen Levitsky, Daniel Ziblatt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with, who is that? The Brookings Institution. Big news, folks. The Lawfare Podcast is now on Spotify. We have answered your calls. I gotta tell you, I have no idea what the equivalent of retweeting something on Spotify or sharing it or liking it, because I've never used Spotify. But whatever you do on Spotify, do it to us. Our music is, of course, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the Hawaii-based Sophia Yan. And as ever, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.